NAPSIS has come a long way and accomplished quite a bit in its 12-year history. It's actually been around long enough to have a history. Ed Wassel has a wonderful way with words, and so I'm going to use Ed's words for a few minutes. Speaking personally as a NAPSIS member, I cannot begin to count the benefits of our membership over the past 5 years. Our accreditation is from NAPSIS. Our teachers are Catholic certified, the only Catholic teachers certification program in the United States through NAPSIS. I have personally been able to glean from other NAPSIS members at the convention tens of ideas to improve the school. Now, I'm sure that Ed meant or left out a couple of zeros there. I'm sure that he meant hundreds or thousands of ideas to improve the school, but we'll let the tens go for that. Many of which we have implemented. In summary, prior to NAPSIS, we were a good, solid Catholic school that taught the faith well and offered a good Catholic education. Today, we have been named for the past 3 years one of the nation's top 50 Catholic high schools by the prestigious Acton Institute, and our national test scores are off the charts. Although it might be an exaggeration to say that without NAPSIS, none of these things would have come to pass, I can say definitively that without the support and help of NAPSIS, we never would have achieved all of the above. NAPSIS is doing more for true Orthodox Catholic education in the United States than any other single entity. Thank you, Ed, for those words. When the first independent schools in service to the church conference was held at Franciscan University in 1998, NAPSIS had 15 member schools with one school accredited. Now we have 61 member schools. Three are homeschool programs, and I'm very proud of that and our connection to homeschool and homeschooling families. 14 schools are accredited, three this year alone. Four schools are candidates for accreditation. And we're looking forward to the NAPSIS Teacher Certification Program being used in the design and development of the first university Catholic teacher preparation and credentialing program. Currently, there is not one teacher credentialing program at any college or university, and that includes Catholic colleges and universities, that is specifically designed to prepare the Catholic teacher in the principles and practices and principles of Catholic education. The person responsible for the first independent schools in service to the Church Conference is Dominic Aquila. Dominic knew from the very beginning the need for and the potential of NAPSIS. Dominic gave the conference its name and organized it along with Carol Carpenter, who is now the Vice President of University Relations here at Ave Maria University. But in 1998, she was Director of Special Events at Franciscan University. Dominic saw a conference on independent schools as a perfect fit in the Franciscan University's summer program of conferences, which they held every year. It was a huge success, and some of you were there and have not missed a conference since. It would be 3 years before the next conference was held at Ave Maria College, Orchard Lake Campus, in 2001, and we have Dominic Aquila to thank for that conference as well. By this time, he was at Ave Maria College and looking to the future of a summer conference series at Ave Maria College. His first thought was of NAPSIS and another independent schools conference. We have Dominic to thank for getting us back on the conference track. We haven't missed a year since. Hosted at Ave Maria College and now at Ave Maria University. I have here, it's an 8-page resume of Dominic's achievements and accomplishments. It's awesome. I'd love to read it all to you It's really amazing. Everything from music, which is just so fascinating, to all of his academic achievements, his publications, his consultations, his educational background, his teaching assignments. He's recently been appointed the Dean of Arts and Sciences at the University of St. Thomas in Houston, Texas, from where he drove the last couple of days with his wife, Diane. And I'm so pleased that she's been able to join him this weekend. And Dominic will be here with us for the weekend. Probably what he's most proud of is the very last sentence in his resume. Married with 11 children. All homeschooled. When I arrived here in Naples a little over a week ago, and I began meeting people on campus and inviting them this evening, and I would mention who was our keynote, they were so excited. Oh, Dominic, my good friend Dominic. And many are here this evening because of Dominic's connections with people from Franciscan University, Ave Maria College, and so many other places that Dominic has been over the years. For me and for all of us here this evening, it's like welcoming a good friend to your home. Come on in, sit down, and tell us what you've been doing since we last saw you. Please welcome to our Napsis home and heart our good friend, Dominic Aquila.
I'm strictly, I'm breathless after an introduction like that. It's certainly undeserving. I'm particularly privileged to have been a part of Ave Maria and the whole rejuvenation of the conferences after 3 years is because of the support of Ave Maria Foundation. And you saw the breadth and the depth of Mr. Monahan's vision for education, Catholic education in America. And without that kind of support, the conferences and the work of Eileen, I cannot overlook her determined single-mindedness and devotion to Napsis. But to be a part of Ave Maria and that wonderful history, and just sitting there listening to the story is, you become enraptured, and to think that I was a part of it. In a way, I am still a part of it, being here, of course, but so many of the graduates already from Ave Maria have come my way. In fact, I've just arrived at the University of St. Thomas in Houston. Literally started there on June 1st, and I'm in the process of hiring my administrative assistant. I'm in effect the founding dean of the School of Arts and Sciences, and one of the candidates is a graduate of Ave Maria School of Law, and that connection immediately was very important. And having a person like that at the University of St. Thomas helps me in the work that I've been doing since I have left Ave Maria. Namely, when I was here, I took very seriously a challenge. It was kind of an implicit challenge that Father Jim Burchell, the former provost of Notre Dame, laid down. He said, once a school has gone down the path of mission drift or has lost its commitment to its identity, it's impossible to turn it back around. And that, I'm always up for a challenge. I said, well, let's see. And so in part, my career has been since leaving Ave Maria to see how well we can turn colleges back around. And Mr. Monahan is absolutely correct. The presence of Ave Maria University, along with Steubenville, has encouraged other schools, other Catholic universities, to think seriously about the Catholic identity. In some cases, it's purely pragmatic. That is, if you're single-minded in your devotion to mission, your mission is clear, you're going to draw students from a certain market segment. And so that's this good business to have a clear mission and vision. But in other cases, in other occasions, it's true. There's a devotion to want to reclaim a patrimony that many people think have been squandered. So without Ave Maria University on the landscape of Catholic colleges and universities, the turnarounds that we're beginning to see in other Catholic schools, and God, I hope, Notre Dame, then I think Ave Maria not only serves its purpose here in educating students in faith and reason in the way that Mr. Monahan has pointed out, but by its presence, what it radiates and its influence nationally, it is having effect in higher education. So I'm very grateful to Mr. Monahan for his work here at Ave Maria, and I continue to benefit from it wherever I travel, most recently the University of St. Thomas in Houston. The first question Mr. Monahan asked me is, how's the theology faculty? My eyes were wide open when I went to St. Thomas. The University of St. Thomas has an extremely well-formed and devoted theology faculty, and also a solid philosophy department, very good English department. But there are, as Mr. Monahan has pointed out, there are pockets that need reforming. Luckily, time is on our side. By attrition, those faculty who see the handwriting on the wall of a turnaround will retire. In fact, there was a conference at Steubenville in April on this very question, and the amount of schools that came there for advice about how to oversee a turnaround was incredible. And Father Michael Scanlon was there, and he was very clear. In fact, he was more direct and clear about his purpose than he ever was when he was president, where he had to be careful, and nuanced about how he spoke. He was very clear. Pray to get rid of bad faculty. Help them. See that they belong somewhere else. What I wanted to speak about tonight, more directly related to Catholic high schools and grade schools, is a line that my revered mentor, Christopher Lash, who passed away in 1994 prematurely. He was very young when he passed away. He gave a talk at a conference on Catholic education in Rochester, New York, at St. John Fisher College. He was there giving a talk with Father Peter Stravinskas. And I was shocked that Lash was there. I had studied with Lash at Rochester, and I knew Lash was very friendly to not only Catholicism, but to, as a secular person, he was very friendly to people of faith. So I found it very curious that he was at this conference on Catholic education, and it wasn't higher education, it was education in primary and secondary schools, and there he was. And he began his talk that night by saying he didn't know why he was there. He got the invitation from this very, very well-educated priest in the Diocese of Rochester who was a champion of Catholic education. He's also passed away, his father, Father James Callan. And so Lash begins with autobiography. And his autobiography only reinforced our puzzlement as to why he was there. Because this is what he said. He said he grew up in the Midwest. He grew up in Omaha, Nebraska. And his mother, in fact, was the first PhD in psychology from Bryn Mawr. His father was a journalist in the Omaha newspaper and senior editor there. He said the only exposure or the only thing he knew about Catholics growing up in the populist Midwest was that he should hate them. That was ingrained in the populist sentiment, this strong anti-Catholicism. And so that formed part of who he was. And I even remember when I took a seminar with him, when we did the 19th century in America, I did Catholic thought in Orestes Bronson, the great 19th century Catholic convert. And he was tolerant but not celebratory of the whole project that I was undertaking. But here he is. with Father Peter Stravinsky giving a talk on Catholic education. And it was the most supportive talk on Catholic education. And he closed by saying, Catholic education is the last best hope for American democracy. I could not believe what I had heard, given what I knew about him and his background. Now, I must say, this man is the gentlest, most humble man that you would ever want to meet. I mean, there was nothing overbearing about him, and smart. He's probably now considered one of the most influential American intellectuals of the 20th century. Books continue to be written about him and his influence. Curiously, books are being written now comparing him and his thought to John Paul II, even though Lash never converted. His work is being compared to the Catholic novelist Walker Percy. Lash never converted. What could he have meant that Catholic education is the last best hope for American democracy? Well, I said in the broadest sense, he could be referring to the fact that education has always been, going back to antiquity, that education is always linked to politics. So education and democracy is an ancient tie. It goes back to Plato, Aristotle, Locke, Rousseau. All of these great thinkers always proposed an educational program to accompany their political reforms, always. They always wrote a book on education, a book on the family, and a book on political theory. So that was the broadest. I said, okay, then what else? Well, education, even the founding of Catholicism in America, was used by the Jesuit missionaries. They went right for the young in the success of the mission schools in California and Texas. They went instinctively to teach the young before they taught the adult Indians in those parts of the country. And they did it by very simple techniques of memorization and liturgical pageantry. Then, after the Jesuits and the Franciscans educated the youth, the very small, then they would go after the leaders in the tribes who they thought were friendly, and that's how they would eventually convert American Indians. So there's another connection. Then recently, I mean, in this broad connection between education and politics, the very fundamental level, this connection is made clear to us today also by the late Monsignor Giussani, and he perhaps had the most articulate statement of the relation between education and political reform. He said, the fundamental idea, and this is Giussani in his great book, The Risk of Education, the fundamental idea in the education of the young is that it is through the younger generations that society successively rebuilds itself. Therefore, the primary concern of society is to teach the young. So, in my puzzlement about what Lash could have meant, coming from his background, that Catholic education was the last best hope for American democracy, I started at that basic level. But there was more. I then moved to the direct level of Catholicism and American democracy, not just politics in the largest sense. Was he thinking about Catholic education in the history of the formation of American democracy? Catholic schools were the single, and scholars have shown this over again, were the single most important institution for the Americanization of huge amounts of immigrants from Europe and elsewhere in America. Was Lash thinking about the parochial schools, a model that was the predominant model that, in a moment I'm going to tell you a little story about that I think offers us some inspiration for the work that you're doing in your independent schools. These parish schools, beginning in the late 19th century, were formed with the intentional purpose to be fully competitive with, if not superior, to local public schools. But even then, back at that time, that was a controversial proposition. Now, where would you expect controversy to come? Well, it would come from precisely the people who Christopher Lash would have grown up with, nativist Americans who feared Roman Catholics. So parish schools, parochial schools, educating huge amount of immigrants would have been and was, in fact, problematic for American nativists. But controversies also about parish schools occurred within the church itself. As Catholic schools in the late 19th century became increasingly similar to public schools, their independence and very reason for existence was threatened. Quoting one historian, advocates of English language parochial schools were faced with the difficulty of arguing both that the schools were American and that they were different from all other American schools. If parochial schools were not demonstrably American, they could not survive pressure from their enemies, like American nativists. And if they were not different, then they had no reason to exist. Why not just send your kids to the public school? Indeed, increasing similarities between parochial and public schools caused concern among some Catholics in the late 1800s. One editor of the Catholic Review, writing in the 1890s, argued that the parochial school, in an effort to Americanize, had strayed from the true path. To this editor's way of thinking, the worst thing that could be said of parochial schools was that they were similar to public schools. Another criticized the increase in the number of courses offered in parochial schools. Quoting this editor, "It savors too much of the pretentious system of brain stuffing and stifling adopted in the public schools." Other Catholics criticized parochial schools for encouraging the materialism found in the public schools and the cultivation of the attitude of the man on the make that was so prevalent in late 19th century America. Now, with this controversy and this idea of a public school in mind, I said, well, being Lash was a nativist, grew up that way, he had discarded those sentiments as an adult, maybe he's celebrating the fact that American Catholic schools provided this Americanizing function for the benefit of American democracy. But there was more to it than that. Lash was very aware that when he was speaking, and this was in the early 1990s, when he was speaking about Catholic education as the last best hope for American democracy, he already knew that Catholic education was in mainstream was in a state of crisis and crisis of confidence in its own mission. He was under no illusions. So he wasn't talking about some state of Catholic education from an ideal world of the 1930s or the 1950s. He knew full well what was going on then and there. Let me return a little bit to some controversies within about Christopher Lash. There's a young man writing a biography of Lash, and he called me up to interview me as a student of Lash. And he said, the book is going fine, except that there's this raging debate about whether or not Lash wanted to convert to Catholicism towards the end of his life. Lash was very close to Dale Vree, the editor of the New Oxford Review. And Dale insists to this author of this biography that Lash was on the verge of converting, that he was going to convert just before he died. Other of Lash's friends at the university say, no, that's complete falsehood. Lash was sympathetic to religion, but he was in no way going to convert. So there's always this tension about Lash, especially as his status increases as an influential intellectual of the 20th century. Dale Vree had actually gotten Lash to think about Catholicism seriously, and he got Lash to visit a church in suburban Rochester, New York. And this all goes to considering, you know, how Lash thought about the Catholic Church in the 1990s. We happened to go to this church that had been thoroughly modernized. There was hardly any real sense of reverence in the liturgy. It was a typical suburban parish. Lash wrote to me and to DeVry, and he said he had hardly had a more tacky experience in his entire life. So, you know, he was completely aware of the problems within the church. But what he did share with the Catholic Church was a faith in the family's right to educate, like the church does, a worry about state control of education. He was entirely one with John Paul II in believing that the focus of education is the building of culture, and culture is for the development of persons. So he had great sympathies with the philosophies and principles of the church. What Lash seemed to be celebrating in Catholic education was not this parochial school system that tried to mimic public schools as, you know, an Americanization project. He knew full well the problems of the church in the 1990s and in education in the 1990s. What he seemed to be admiring, and this yet a deeper level of thinking about what this could mean, that Catholic education is the last best hope for American democracy, is that he liked this idea of the church spawning reform of itself generation after generation. As bleak as we see things around us, we also see the seeds of reform and rejuvenation. Ave Maria University, where we're right now, is a sign of that. The new orders that are emerging in the church. The church is a history of this reforming through the efforts of what the historian Arnold Toynbee calls creative minorities. Now, Lash was a historian himself. He appreciated that aspect, and he saw that in the church, the use of creative minorities. And as you probably know, Pope Benedict XVI has picked up that term. When Pope Benedict XVI looks at the collapse of Christianity and Catholicism in Europe, he quotes Toynbee and saying, "I have faith in creative minorities." I'm speaking, and I have to always say this. I'm speaking on a purely natural realm here. Of course, the Holy Spirit and Jesus' admonition that the gates of hell will never prevail against the church, that's all operative. So I'm speaking more at the natural level. What Lash saw is this kind of scrappiness, this reform, this ability to reform from the seeds of what seemed to be failures all around. And that's what attracted him. But there's a deeper level, the deepest level, that I'll get to at the very end. But let's probe this thing of creative minorities. And let's return, because this is particularly applicable to the project of NAPSIS. Before the Catholic schools emerged that I knew growing up and many of us attended in the 50s and the 60s, the parish parochial school, that model was not the only model that was showing promise in the late 19th century. As you probably know, Catholicism was deeply suspect in America. Catholics did not want to send their kids to public schools. Not all, some did. There was a raging debate within the hierarchy of the United States in the 19th century about what Catholics should do. Should they go to public schools and do religious instruction on top of it? Should they form their own schools? There were three models that emerged with great promise as a result of this tension between a Catholic immigrant minority and a dominant Protestant majority. The first model was called the public church partnership. And I'm not going to get too deeply into this because my purpose in presenting this is something different. This is where churches actually work with local school boards and got funding from the school boards. And these school boards would use church property, and the church would have a say at what teachers were hired. They would get the funding. They would have the right of hiring and firing teachers. They would select the books to be used. So they wouldn't use the King James, but they would use the Douay-Rheims back then. And these schools educated quite a few people. They were popular in Boston and New York. The one that lasted the longest was in Poughkeepsie. And it would have continued to exist if there wasn't a law passed in New York that forbid this kind of cooperation. But that educated many, and it was a popular model. The second model were the ethnic schools, and these were particularly popular among German American immigrants. For Germans, the key to sustaining their culture and their Catholicism was language. And they did not want Americanized schools. They wanted their own German language schools that would teach English as well. But the Germans, as many of you would know this, is that culture is supreme for Germans. The faith lives and breathes through culture. So German American and their schools, the ethnic schools, was the second model that was very popular in the mid to late 19th century. The third model is the one we know, the parochial parish school, which was devised intentionally to compete with local public schools. The idea was is that it would do everything the public school would do, but do it better, have at least as good an education, but with religious instruction, and achieve what public schools did, but even at a higher level. And in many cases, this was very successful. There was that danger, though. The church is always in this dilemma. We're in the world, but we're not of the world. And whenever you engage the world, you run the risk of being co-opted by the world. And so those critics of the parochial school model that I gave you just a minute ago, they saw the seeds of what probably happened in the 1960s, is that the capitulation to the public school system, government funding, wanting to be as prestigious as those schools, overtook the desire to be faithful to the church. And that caused this, and in the 60s, it was widespread crisis of confidence in Catholic schools. That's the end of these models. We could talk about these models, they're very interesting, but the point is that the model of Catholic education that we know, we're most familiar with, was one of three competing models. This means that our tradition of education is a tradition of experimentation. There were many different models. These were the three dominants, but many others were tried. Napsis is a model, an experiment. When historians look at all the various attempts to try to educate in the Catholic tradition, primary, secondary schools, there's one element that all of them have in common. And this has been the case since the 1830s. Sacrifice, self-sacrifice. My bishop, when I was in the Diocese of Fort Wayne, South Bend, Bishop John Darcy, every time he spoke to the faculty at the University of St. Francis, every time he did a commencement talk, he never let the students forget, what you're enjoying here is the fruit of great sacrifice by sisters who came here with nothing in 1875. But that's the key, self-sacrifice. So when all of us trying to build schools are sacrificing whatever, we share a solidarity with all of those who went before us in this vein. Independent schools should indeed take to heart this tradition of experimentation. It promised, because independent Catholic schools at this point promised to become a significant force for the reform of Catholic and non-Catholic education in this country. Now that may seem a crassly optimistic statement, but Eileen gave statistics already. We saw this bold vision of Mr. Monahan about a Catholic university. It's boldness. It's a bold vision with behind it a tradition of sacrifice. So pardon my optimism, but I have to say that independent schools have this potential to be a highly significant force in education. The current state of Catholic independent schools is marked by scrappiness and an ability to innovate quickly within the tradition, such that it can take advantage of opportunities that would take the more staid traditional Catholic schools longer to embrace, if they even care to do so at all. The experimentation that I am advocating is paradoxical. We may call it a radical traditionalism. It recognizes that current institutional arrangements to educate the young, and increasingly their parents, are often prudential accidents of history and not the perfect work of God and man. What do I mean? The Paris school that we are so familiar with was a historical product. It won out over competing models. Those models were viable. Now, the traditional parochial school, Paris school, I think still is in the throes of a crisis. And we, independent schools, are a challenge to that because of our agility, because of the return to fundamentals that these schools represent. So the educational arrangements are not forever. They are not ordained. They are not absolute. We mold them and remold them and reform them according to the accidents of history and what is necessary at this historical moment. Radical traditionalism. Let's look at the traditional part first. In this reform, part of the reform is to reaffirm, restate, and be committed to certain principles of the Catholic intellectual tradition. And I just listed 10. We could have a really nice discussion about how thorough or incomplete this list is. First, the Catholic intellectual tradition in the way we educate presupposes God, it's theocentric. God is the source and end of all things. Second, it's Trinitarian. The doctrine of the Trinity is definitive of Christianity. It's incarnational. Now, this is, again, as Mr. Monahan says, I feel like I'm preaching to the choir, you know all this. But this could be quite remarkable to some schools. I just heard yet another one of these horror stories in a high school in Buffalo, New York, that a student who believed these very things was ridiculed by teachers in that school for superstition. So, I mean, this is not a one fight. Third, incarnational. Christ is true God and true man who entered human history at a particular time and particular place. Christianity is nothing if not an historical faith. Christ is the center of history and the pattern for humanity and for the renewal of culture. Fourth, it's sacramental. The centrality to our education is the Eucharist and a common liturgical life. Fifth, we believe in the unity of Scripture as an inspired, indeed, even when it is read as a literary text, it's unified. We read Scripture, and Carlo Ratzinger has come out very strongly to reassert this belief in Scripture in his new book, Jesus of Nazareth. Sixth, we believe in the complementary roles of inspiration and authority, of how the Holy Spirit works in a hierarchical church. Seven, we are apostolic, serving the holiness of life and witness to the truth of faith. We place our intelligence in the service of Christ the King. Catholic educators, in the words of John Paul II, have the privileged task to unite existentially by intellectual effort two orders of reality that too frequently tend to be placed in opposition as though they were antithetical. And what are these two? The search for truth and the certainty of already knowing the fount of truth in Jesus Christ. This is paradoxical. We're searching for the truth, and at the same time, we are certain, we're already certain that we know this truth. And the fathers of the church used to call this faith seeking understanding. Eighth, we believe in a theocentric humanism, holding fast to the dignity of the human person and all human beings because they are created in the image of God. Ninth, we have a commitment to teaching, and by teaching, we mean it as a vocation and as a model for the unity of life that we want our education to achieve in our students. And 10, it is integrative. We integrate, restoring unity to a fragmented world by forming in our students a habit of mind that seeks the unity and ordering of knowledge and the unity of faith and reason. Those 10 principles are foundational to the Catholic intellectual tradition. Your list may be slightly different than mine, but it's a place to start. That's the traditional part of this radical traditionalism that I'm advocating and that I see as the great promise for independent schools. Now for the radical part. The radical part takes its beginnings from the 10th point I mentioned, integration. There's been much discussion of the need for an integrative vision of education in Catholic higher education. Now, I'm about to say it comes from Catholic higher education, but I believe firmly that it applies to Catholic high schools and even grade schools, inasmuch as it begins to form a habit of mind. I'm going to quote something from Cardinal George. Several years ago, in a widely publicized lecture that Cardinal George delivered at Georgetown University and later at a meeting of Chicago area scholars, Cardinal George argued that a university without a unifying vision is simply a high-class trade school. Many seemed puzzled by this remark, assuming that he was referring to a general erosion of university academic standards that put higher education at the level of vocational training. But as he later pointed out, as Cardinal George pointed out, high-class trade schools are very important institutions. And he did not hesitate to list Harvard and Yale among them. But he went on to add that if they have lost any kind of truly integrating vision, then in fact they are there to serve an individual sense of mission, an individual purpose, and the demands of individual disciplines which are left unintegrated except in the desire of students themselves and the academic vocation of those who feel accountable to their discipline. The classical ideal of university education presupposed that its ultimate goal was to train students to see things whole. In contrast, the trade school was marked by a new emphasis on the university as a mere carrier of disciplines. As such, it simply presides over a set of disciplinary guilds, each anxious to protect its autonomy and increase its relative influence. Now think about this. The independent Catholic schools, secondary and primary, you're educating students to do what? To go where? To go into a university that Cardinal George basically has called a high-class trade school. There is, one can say, they've let slip this integrating vision. University means united towards one truth in one direction. There's a sense of a unity that all of this that we study means something as a whole. It's not any longer just mission slip. Universities no longer just have lost their way. There's a deliberate intentionality that says that vision of a university as one is passé. And so already in the 1960s, the chancellor of the University of California system, Clark Kerr, said we now talk about a multiversity, multiplicity of truths. So no university. Now think about this. We're training our students in grade schools and high schools to go where? If we don't supply an integrative vision and create the desire for that integration, when we send our schools, and we're very proud when our students go to Yale and Harvard and Princeton and Ave Maria University and Steubenville and wherever else, if there's not an integrating vision, then we're not educating students in the Catholic tradition. Another writer, Alistair MacIntyre, the University of Notre Dame, has also insisted on the integrating task of the university. He goes even further. In a talk he gave in Notre Dame and then an article he wrote for Commonweal, which is very controversial, he says either the university takes up this integrating vision or it goes out of business. In other words, why would parents increasingly pay $40,000, $50,000 a year to send their kids to a university where there isn't something distinctive about it? Is a Catholic university only the fact that you have very good academics like Harvard or Yale, and you have a chaplain there, and you have some religious instruction? and people are nice. Well, you can get that in many places now. In fact, if I sampled websites of certain secular universities, they would sound to you very Catholic by what they propose. But is there an integrating vision? This is what seems to be missing. Now, this is the controversy going at Catholic universities. It is never too early to bring that integrative vision, to form it in our students. Pope John Paul II was a tireless advocate for this integrating vision in everything. I recently found a talk he gave to the Pontifical Academy of Sciences. I had not discovered it. One of the sisters at University of St. Thomas, who's a scientist, showed it to me. This is what the Pope says. He said in this address to the scientists, "So much of our world seems to be in fragments, in disjointed pieces. So much of human life is passed in isolation or in hostility. The division between rich nations and poor nations continues to grow. The contrast between northern and southern regions of our planet becomes ever more marked and intolerable. The antagonism between races and religions splits countries into warring camps. Historical animosities show no signs of abating. In the academic community, the separation between truth and values persists, and the isolation of their several cultures, scientific, humanistic, and religious, makes common discourse difficult, if not at times impossible." Now, what I found so interesting about this talk the Pope gave is that many people complain about over-specialization in schools. And this gets pushed down to the high schools now, right? Many high schoolers are being told they must commit, especially if they want to be doctors, that they must commit earlier and earlier to a scientific track, that they must professionalize their curriculum. So this fragmentation and specialization is pushed further and further back in the channel. The Pope was so distraught about this, he actually coined a term I'd never heard of before. He said, what needs to happen in Catholic education, especially in higher education, is a bridging ministry. A bridging ministry. Imagine that, a bridging ministry. Some folks who would make it their business to make sure that conversations happen among the disciplines. And those conversations are often very difficult to have because you need a common ground to speak with. In a Catholic university, our Catholic intellectual tradition ought to provide that common ground. Now, immediately there's an objection to what I've said about an integrating vision, a sense of unity of all knowledge for students in high schools. Because in our system of education, there's a strong, and I think a right belief, that students in high school and grade school ought to get the training in the disciplines. They ought to get the knowledge, the data of history, of mathematics, of English, of good writing, and of all of that. And that's very true. But what I'm talking about in this radical traditionalism is not to have our students be airy dilettantes, that they sort of, you know, straddle disciplines and never learn anything but learn lots of connections. Rather, what I'm talking about is informing students a habit of mind, a desire to grasp an integrating vision, so that when they leave us and they go to places such trade schools as Harvard, that they will have the tools to integrate and therefore benefit from the Catholic intellectual tradition. Now, I had another curious thing happen. I was talking with a Basilian priest. The Basilian fathers run the University of St. Thomas. And I met a priest there named Father Callum, who was he's the chaplain of the campus. He had a fabulous education before college. In college, he couldn't understand this talk of Alistair MacIntyre about college being an integrating vision of interdisciplinarity. He said, when I was in college, he said, all I did was mathematics. He said, and I got smug about mathematics. I mean, he said, literature is the kind of thing you do at home in your spare time. He said, I took mathematics courses and more mathematics courses and more mathematics courses. as a collegiate undergraduate. He said, that integrative stuff, well, I did that in high school. He had already had that formation, so that for him, a college, the baccalaureate degree, was the time for this intense specialization. Now, as a religious, religious are often called upon to abandon one career track and start on something radically new. His superiors tell him one day, Father Callum, this is what we want you to do. We're going to send you to Oxford, and you're going to get a degree in patristics and theology. That's the end of his mathematics. But that ability to integrate, however he developed it, enabled him to become a fabulous, successful scholar in patristics, even with a very specialized undergraduate degree. What I don't mean by integration, there are certain dangers here, and I always had this experience with Catholic homeschoolers. In a delightful attempt to try to make everything Catholic, we wound up using the rosary for math problems, counting how many saints there are. Everything became, and there's nothing wrong with this, it's just, I think for kids it gets to be a little too much. I don't mean integration in that way. And I also think there's, in Catholic homeschooling circles, there's a danger of being too broad, too worried about connections without concern for the disciplines and their integrity. There, maybe some of you know this curriculum. It's called Konos. It's a curriculum that my wife and I got exposed to when we first moved to Steubenville. Some parents were using it. And it was very interesting because it would have a very complicated matrix of interconnections. So that if you're doing Shakespeare, it immediately takes you into English history and what was going on at that time. But the danger is that students who don't have the attention, well, they would forget to read the Shakespeare and worry about the history too much. They would make these very interesting superficial connections, but never get down to the integrity of the work. And so what we need, again, at the level of high school and grade school, is not so much an abandonment of the tools of learning, of the concrete content of learning, but a habit of mind that looks for integration. There is the question of time in all this. But before, there's one more point. I think even if we can't do integration at the level that, should go on in a university, there is an ideal that we ought to set before our students, no matter how young they are. Teenagers, young students even below that age, are terribly idealistic. You probably know this wonderfully titled book about Jose Maria Escrivá called Dreams. Dream and your dreams will fall short. Isn't that a wonderful title? I mean, dream and your dreams will fall short. He started Opus Dei and the most incredible adverse conditions, at the point where in order for Opus Dei to go on, they want to remove him as its leader. I mean, so it was really a lot of adversity he went through. Dream and your dreams will fall short. The image of very great men and what they do to be held up, and women, to be held up to our students, it's never too early for that. I'm going to quote here from a very a Catholic scholar who thought lots about integration and the Catholic intellectual tradition. Some of you may know him, Father Sertilange. He was a French Dominican. And he wrote a wonderful book called The Intellectual Life, As a Catholic Would Live It. And this is what he says about integration. He says, very great men have always shown themselves to be more or less universal. Excelling in one branch, they were intelligently interested, often competent, sometimes specialized in others. You could not have confined to a single compartment men like Aristotle, Bacon, Leonardo da Vinci, Leibniz, or Goethe. Sertilange assures his reader that in some proportion, each person can attain to the breadth of mind represented by such giant figures. Sertilange says, make yourself a broad plan, which will gradually be narrowed down as regards the time devoted to each secondary study, but never as regards breadth of view and the spirit of your work. So, in fact, he recommended integration as the first calling of a Catholic teacher, to be looking for integration. People say, where am I going to get the time for this? All right, that's the especially those of us who are in the trenches teaching. Where does the time come? Father Sertolange says this about that. He's not put off at all by objections that time does not allow for broad cultivation of mind in our age of ever-increasing specialized knowledge. Quoting Sertolange, for the lights thrown by one subject on another will make everything easier. As you acquire breadth of mind, your mind will grow more receptive and less easily burdened. Breadth of learning and study is the intellectual action necessary and the corollary on the part of the individual to grasp the unity of all truth present in the created order beyond the human person. Sertolange makes this point by way of an anecdote about a linguist who could be conversant in a new language in a matter of 2 weeks because he knew many other languages. At a glance, he grasped the spirit of the new idiom, its fundamental characteristics, its whole structure. Now the different branches of knowledge are the different languages in which nature, the inexpressible, is laboriously stammered out by men. To decipher several of these languages helps each of the others, for at bottom they are all one. They get this unity of all truths. In 1920, Father Sertolange saw the great need for Catholic education was the restoration of harmony, an appeal to the vision of concord that has long been the ideal of the Catholic intellectual tradition. Sertolange says, if the intellectual Catholic, and this he meant teachers especially, belongs to his time, he could do nothing better than work for his part at restoring the order that we lack. What from the point of view of doctrine is wanting in the knowledge of our time is not positive content, it is harmony, an ability to take doctrine and harmonize it with other branches of learning in the world. Now, how do you demonstrate this unity to students? Well, Dante is a good place to go. And here's why. In the Paradiso, and the book 10 and 11, you get a poetic vision, perhaps the most elegant that I've ever read in the tradition of Western literature, about the importance of the unity of truth for the sake of acquiring wisdom. In book 10, canto 10 rather, canto 10 and canto 11 of Paradiso. Now, Divine Comedy is Dante in the middle of his life at the age of 35 is losing steam. He's losing his sense of the faith. He's confused. He's in a dark wood. And he's gradually taken, first by a pagan poet who he admires, Virgil, taken through hell, the inferno, then up through Mount Purgatory, and then finally to paradise, where he's escorted by Beatrice. And so Beatrice is accompanying him in paradise, which is many layered. And he gets to a sphere, and it's a very important moment in the paradise. They move to the center, in this sphere, they're in the center of two wheels that they see in the heavens. And they're two wheels of souls, forming, in effect, a little mini cosmos. Each of these circles contains 12 wise souls, unranked in their order of importance. The spokesman for the first circle is St. Thomas Aquinas. The spokesman for the second is St. Bonaventure, the great Franciscan. All the souls on the first wheel, except for Solomon, and he represents noble prudence, all the other souls are teachers or doctors of learning, doctors of the church, doctors of philosophy, doctors of theology. They were more luminous than the sun, says Dante, and by their dance-like circular motion, they create an incomparable harmony that compels an immediate, unmediated act of grateful adoration from Dante. Quoting the Paradiso, such is this place was the fourth family of the High Father, whoever sates it, showing how he breathes forth and how begets. And Beatrice began, give thanks, give thanks unto the Son of Angels, who to this sensible one has raised thee by his grace. Never was heart of mortal so disposed to worship, nor to give itself to God with all its gratitude, was it so ready, as at those two worlds did I myself become. And all of my love was so absorbed in him that in oblivion Beatrice was eclipsed. Now, this did not displease her, but she smiled at it, and so that the splendor of her laughing eyes my single mind on many things divided. Lights many saw I, vivid and triumphant, make us a center in themselves, a circle, more sweet in voice than luminous in aspect. After this hymn of praise to this harmony of intellect, St. Thomas introduces the 11 members of the circle that he's in, beginning with his teacher, Albert the Great, who's on his immediate right. And then he concludes with Siger of Brabant on his left. Now, Siger was a philosopher and a theologian with whom St. Thomas disagreed. The inclusion of Siger next to Thomas signals not only that the earnest pursuit of truth has merit, but also that debate within certain limits is necessary to complete the circle of knowledge and wisdom. Concluding this canto, Dante writes, "Thus I beheld the glorious wheel move round and render voice to voice in modulation and sweetness that cannot be comprehended." Then this wheel with St. Thomas recedes, and another wheel comes forward, and the second wheel, the wheels are spinning in sort of a harmony. And the second wheel, the spokesman is St. Bonaventure. And what Dante does to show the unity, because these were the two new orders in the church at the time, the Dominicans and the Franciscans. They were mendicant orders meant to go out of monasteries into the world. And each had their own very different charism, but there was a unity. And so very cleverly what Dante does, maybe you know this who know the poem, is he has, when St. Thomas steps forward, St. Thomas gives not a discourse in praise of St. Dominic, Thomas is a Dominican, but rather he gives the biography of St. Francis of Assisi. And you know, very praiseworthy biography. When St. Bonaventure steps forward from his wheel, he steps forward, he's a Franciscan, he returns the favor by giving a laudatory account of St. Dominic. And so by this device, the wheels and the cross praise, Dante is poetically giving us the importance of the unity of truth for wisdom. If we're going to attain wisdom, that's what's going to take. One more point about this unity. What I found so captivating about that little excerpt I read from Pope John Paul II in his address to the scientists is that he begins the fragmentation of the academy in the world. That the fragmentation we see in the world is repeated in the academy. It's as if to say, of all places, there shouldn't be that fragmentation in the university. There's the place, at the very least, we can have this unity. So with this notion of building harmony, it extends beyond just the university itself, but it extends to what independent schools can be doing that no other schools are equipped or perhaps willing to do. Already we see that independent schools have partnerships, building bridges with homeschoolers, creating a unity there. There are other things that independent schools, I think, are particularly well suited to do. For example, picking up certain threads from that were discussed in the 1960s and 70s during the first great crisis of confidence in Catholic education. One of these proposals was put forth by a man named Alfred Kube and then Russell Shaw, who I think many of you know, in a book called SOS for Catholic Schools. And there they were talking about reformulating Catholic schools to be more adult-centered rather than child-centered. Now, I don't know if I would want to go there, but it certainly is the case, and I think from your own experience, from what I know, is that Your educational apostolate is not just to students, but to parents and families. A generation has gone by that has not been well formed. And so the stuff that I'm talking about in this Catholic intellectual tradition, matters of faith, simple doctrinal questions, are not present in parents. And so there is an apostolate here that includes reaching families, and that's an innovative enterprise. One more I would suggest, and this is something of national scope, is that the last conference of governors, 50 governors, report after report show that students entering college are not prepared to undertake college work, whether it be vocational schools like Yale or other schools. They just are not prepared to do collegiate work. And so there's this big effort for alignment. Now, there's dangers in that, to be sure, especially the way that discussion is being handled right now. It's all about outcomes and, you know, test scores. What if independent schools took up the mantle of a challenge similar to the challenge of immigration in the 19th century? That's still a challenge for us today. But to take the lead on alignment and partnering specifically with Catholic schools, again, this proceeds from something you're already doing. Many of the independent schools have great relationships with Steubenville or TAC. How about expanding that? So work on an alignment. I'm telling you that Catholic universities and colleges would love beginning such a conversation like that. In fact, from my end at the collegiate level, when we're looking to attract and retain students, we want to move further and further back in the educational channel. And I would welcome any kind of conversation that helps to align what is needed in college with what's going on in the schools. Now, having looked closely at this crucial element of Catholic education, forming this integrated habit of mind, I think I'm finding the deepest level of what Christopher Lash might have meant by saying Catholic education as the last best hope for American democracy. And I come to it by way of analogy. In universities and in high schools, there is an increasing emphasis on the specialization of knowledge. Whereas what we know as the ideal of Catholic education, of wisdom, requires some sort of integrative vision, some sort of unity, and there's a distance there. Lash spent his entire academic career studying American democracy. And what worried him the most was the rule of experts. He was, after all, a populist. He wrote a book, one of his last books was The Revolt of the Elites, which is a ringing cry, celebration of, and critique of elites, but a celebration of populists who turned out to be, many times, Catholics. And what he was arguing for is something that you see in the academy, you see in the political order as well. We have a political order that is run by experts. Going back to the 1920s with a very well-known American intellectual named Walter Lippmann, argued that it is impossible to have democracy anymore because things are just too complicated, too much specialized knowledge. How can we ever require citizens to understand the ins and outs of nuclear power, of international trade? How can they, you know, they don't have the time, they don't have the inclination. So democracy, because of specialization, which is comparable to the specialization of disciplines in the academy, results in a loss of an integrative vision. If democracy means that we're all supposed to understand the decisions that affect our lives, there's a powerful forces that won't accept that. Lash would not agree. He believed that the forming of a certain habit of mind, not that we can all be experts, but a habit of mind that knows how to link things would make us better citizens. And so at the end of the day, at the very deepest level, Lash spoke better than he knew about the integrative vision of a Catholic education and its role for true American democracy. Now again, my emphasis this evening has been on the social, political, and cultural uses of Catholic education. But this should not at all detract from the ultimate purpose of Catholic education, which is to build a culture that provides men and women with the intellectual, spiritual, and moral formation they need to gain eternal life, and to do our best to build a culture worthy of Christ the King, with full faith that at the end of days, Christ our Lord will supply what is missing and offer it all to the Father for us. May it be so. Thank you.
We've come to the point in our evening just before we conclude for the annual Space Nostra Award. This award is given annually to an individual or an organization whose work exemplifies Our Lady's hope. All of our schools are dedicated to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, our life, our sweetness, and our hope. This person fulfills the NAPSIS standards of excellence through model leadership in the preservation of Catholic identity by loyalty and obedience to the Pope and Magisterium. I don't think there's much doubt in the room this evening as to who the recipient is for this year's Space Nostra Award. We've just witnessed, experienced a tremendous teacher who has left us all with wanting to learn more. We've all got questions, and it's that desire for knowledge that as a teacher, we would all love to have that gift. But before I make the formal announcement of this year's recipient, John Camprath would like to share a few thoughts with us.
Thank you, Eileen. Thank you, everybody. Dominic. I think we all know Dominic Aquila in some capacity. I would say he is certainly a man of culture. He shared that tonight. And my experience with him goes back to Steubenville when I was a student, a graduate student in their theology program, and we had just moved to town, and I really met this wonderful man and family of culture who was in the neighborhood that I moved into, where town and gown, hearth and study all merged together beautifully. I recall one of the very first weeks, I think my wife was out jogging, she was a jogger, and Dominic was just taking that up, I believe, himself at that time. Dominic, you look terrific, by the way. and he welcomed her outside their home and chatted for some time, and my wife was a historian, a budding historian, and they had some great conversations, and they hit it off immediately. Around the campus, as I went on to study, there was a certain reputation of this wonderful, wonderful jewel in the history department, and that was Dominic, and he had quite a reputation, and his lectures were quite famous. And he organized many, many events well beyond just the initial Catholic schools, independent schools, and service to the church conference. And he'd bring in many wonderful speakers to share their knowledge with the people. And there was always this idea of the integration of knowledge that Dominic was key at bringing. At the university, he was instrumental, at Franciscan University, he was instrumental in their drive to develop a core curriculum, and the university to today is indebted to him for those efforts among the faculty, and he was certainly one of the primary leaders there. And it was a fascinating debate to follow as a grad student reading in the various little journals that were published by the school. It was all centered around this movement that Dominic and a few others were spearheading. Then, as I was studying theology and I decided I didn't want to merely, say, teach theology in a Catholic high school, I'd like to try to embrace the whole of Catholic education and the reform there. I saw the independent schools movement as a wonderful thing to get involved in, and sure enough, there were a handful of professors who wanted to found an independent private Catholic school in the area, and Dominic was on the ground floor with that, and he came to many coffee clutch meetings over at the Almeida's house, and I remember, as probably many of you have had these similar experiences, sitting around a kitchen table discussing what is the very best way to start off a Catholic school and Dominic was there to help us and to give instrumental ideas, whether it was from curriculum to evaluating teacher candidates, and his prudence and his wisdom was much, much treasured by us who started the school. As Eileen referenced, there's this enormous curriculum vitae for Dominic. He is a graduate of the Juilliard School of Music, and I have a much more modest background in music, but I was just delighted to learn that of Dominic, and we had many conversations about music and sacred music and the glory of the liturgy. And this is truly a man of great culture. And I recall the last time that Dominic was host to one of these conferences, and when the conference was over, he challenged everyone in attendance that, hey, you've encountered many tens and tens and tens of ideas, as Ed Wassel would say, but maybe you should pick three or four or five key things that struck you as really instrumental to what you take away from the event. And I'd like to just end with those wise words of Dominic that I recall and I think of every time I attend any sort of conference, that throughout this weekend that you would take his advice and focus in on those things that can be sort of cardinal points that you can hang all the many good ideas that you're going to be learning and trying to implement in your schools the time to come. So Dominic, thank you. Thank you for joining us and your wonderful talk tonight. I'll turn it back to Eileen.
He's the friend we all want to have and the guy we would all love to have live next door. We're so grateful that Dominic and Diane are going to be here with us for the entire weekend. It'll give us lots of opportunity to ask all those questions that you have. Please join me in showing your respect and acknowledging this year's recipient of the 2007 Space Nostra Award, Dominic Aquila. Dominic asked us to pardon his optimism. We are so grateful for his optimism.
I cannot tell you what this award means to me. Our Lady Seat of Wisdom, a lady of hope. I'm just speechless. I'm very grateful. But I know that the real work is all what you're doing in various parts of the country. And I want you to know, I may not live next door to you, but with modern technology and internet, and now I have my BlackBerry with me all the time, you can call me, email me, and I'm just happy to help in any way that I can. Because you're all hope. This is the hope. So thank you so much. I'm very grateful.